Welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Donald Trump was elected the 45th president of the United States, running a rather unconventional campaign. He earned only one major newspaper endorsement. Some key Republican leaders wouldn't endorse him. Others did so only half-heartedly. He relied more on Twitter than political ads, and at times he seemed removed from the campaign trail, even within weeks of the election. And he unapologetically made outright racist, sexist, and xenophobic remarks to fire up his base and draw the attention of the media. And yet, now, he is poised to take power with Republican majorities in both houses of Congress. Last night, people across the country took to the streets to repudiate Trump. In San Francisco, Oakland, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Austin, Seattle, Portland, L.A., and many other cities, thousands protested Trump's brand of politics and the agenda they see emerging in Washington. Since he clinched the nomination, many people are asking, how did we get here? And progressives in particular are asking, if the Democrats and the folks who support them want to win elections in the future, what lessons should be learned? Joining me today to discuss this election and what lessons we should begin to draw from it, understanding it's still very early days, are Ian Haney-Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Ian is a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, and that's where he joins us on the line. Ian, thanks so much for coming back on Your Call.
Delighted to join you.
Great to have you. Also with us is Thomas Sugrue, professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University. He's author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race, and most recently, These United States, A Nation in the Making, 1890 to the Present. Hi, Thomas. Great to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
So let me first just ask both of you, obviously, anyone who's really engaged with politics in this country and how it works has spent the last whatever number of hours it is since we've kind of really saw where this campaign was, where this election was headed, wondering what happened, trying to understand it and take it in. And I wonder, I just start with both of you, just a very basic observation, what, you know, from what you're seeing of the, how people are analyzing what happened. And, you know, obviously this is a multi-layered thing when we talk about the American electorate. It's complicated. It's spread out. You know, it's both very local, and then there are also kind of, you know, global things that affect it. What strikes you? What stands out to you in the analysis you're hearing? And kind of what you would rise to the top of trying to understand understand this moment. Let's start with you, Ian.
I think this is about race. Race is complicated. So there's lots of permutations. There's lots of variations. But this is racism in a way that is unique to 2016, but also racism in a way that's deeply connected to American politics for the last half century. If we look at Trump's support, it came overwhelmingly from whites. These are whites who were willing to vote for a candidate who was endorsed by the Klan, espoused positions that described Mexicans as rapists, that called for the banning of Muslims, that trashed African Americans as people who live in hell and deserve stop and frisk. So these are whites who are voting for one of the most racially reactionary politicians we've seen in this country since the recalcitrant South. At the same time, Donald Trump received the same proportion of the white vote as Mitt Romney. And this connects up what happened with Donald Trump to a larger pattern where the Republican Party, as a matter of strategy, for the last 50 years, has principally banked on white racial resentment to build support for the policy preferences of their corporate donors.
So let me ask you, I want to get Thomas to weigh in as well. I mean, obviously, there's this really strong narrative that's been, in the last 36 hours, that which at least connected to what you're talking about, is saying, oh, this is a white working class, a surge of white working class support that put Donald Trump over the top in key states. So first, I'd just like to, the idea of talking about, whiteness that you talk about, but talking about the working class element of that. And second, but there also, I mean, one of the other parts of the analysis has been that African Americans didn't show up in the numbers that they did before. Latinos didn't vote as strongly for Democrats and Hillary Clinton as had been projected. How does that fit into your analysis?
Well, I could jump in on that.
Sure,
one
go ahead,
and say
Thomas.
That one of the challenges that the Clinton campaign faced was mobilizing support among voters of color, and she fell behind. She fell behind from 2012. So part of it was Trump's ability to win not just working class whites, but middle class whites, whites making above average incomes. But the other part of the story was, for all sorts of reasons, Clintonism and the last 8 years of economic policy coming out of Washington has not been particularly great for working class people, regardless of their color. And so there, I think, was justifiable suspicion about the Clinton candidacy from folks who have, especially people of color, who bore the brunt of the Great Recession, bore the brunt of the mortgage and foreclosure crisis, and haven't seen haven't seen a lot of the improvements that were promised by Obama or Clinton. So we're, there are two sides to the story, I think, and it's worrisome. I think Clinton ultimately tried to fashion a message that reached out to working class folks, but I don't think she was nearly as persuasive to many of them as she could have been or as a different Democratic candidate might have been.
Ian?
So I'd say, at least in the way this conversation has been framed so far, it's taking on a race versus class dynamic, and I don't think either of us, either Thomas or I, would actually agree with that. I actually think that we need to begin to combine our conversations of race and class. So in my remarks, I did not say that this was about the white working class.
I know you didn't. I'm just saying that's out there, so I wanted to have you connect those.
I think it is out there, and it's a way of, I think in some ways, expressing sympathy for the Trump supporters, saying, listen, these are people who've suffered in a rigged economy, and at the same time, it's a way of exonerating them, of saying, hey, they are victims. I agree that they are victims of a rigged economy, but I also think it's important that we grapple with the way in which they are victimizers. They are willing to vote for a candidate who says things will be better if we just inflict violence on these other folks. Right. And so this is really race and class working together. And I think it's important to note that Clinton won the vote among people earning less than $50,000 a year. These are not the people most ravaged, most marginalized in our economy. These are people who are struggling but are relatively well off compared to some others. So how is it that they're nevertheless articulating their concerns in these class, in this rhetoric of class? And I think we have to understand that class in the United States has been composed in racial terms, has been structured in racial terms, both in terms of whites and access to certain neighborhoods, certain schools, certain jobs, but also in terms of what class means. For many whites, being well off economically means being able to avoid people of color, not having to encounter them in the grocery store, in the line at the post office, in your workplace. And at the same time, being poor means either being surrounded by people of color or being yourself a person of color. And this sort of conversation has to be integral as we begin to talk to the working class. Not because we cannot continue to talk about improving the lot of the working class without talking to working people in America, without talking to the 99% about the way in which race is a weapon that has kept us from seeing our shared, not just our common economic interests, but more fundamentally our shared humanity.
That's Ian Haney-Lopez. He's a professor of law at University of California, Berkeley, author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Also with us today on Your Call is Thomas Sugrue. He's professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU and author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we invite you to join this conversation about Tuesday's election, about the conclusions that we can draw from what happened, who showed up, who didn't, and how, particularly looking at Democrats and the left, what the lessons should be or that should be learned here. The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. I see the lines lighting up. So if you want to send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's also a great way to do it. feedback@yourcallradio.org. I just wanted to just pick up on some of what you're talking about, the way that in our political analysis it's race versus class. And I mean, I think often when we talk about, you know, we're talking about the Latino voter, we're talking about African Americans and how their voting patterns, it's done in a pretty unnuanced way, particularly with relation to class. Do we know anything? I mean, obviously you kind of cite statistics about what we know about people below a certain level of income and how they voted, but do we know if there are some class distinctions in voting patterns when it comes to group, you know, minority groups, groups that are the non-white, soon to be majority in California?
All I'd say on that is I suspect so, but that's not something that I could speak to authoritatively.
Yeah, no, it just seems like that's often really, it's unconsidered in terms of who people are and what drives them as voters. I want to bring in our first caller, Bill in San Francisco. Bill, welcome to Your Call. Bill, are you with us? Well, let's follow up with you all to talk to. I'm interested in your reaction. You know, yesterday we had both Hillary Clinton making her concession speech and Barack Obama talking about the transition to a Trump White House. Both very conciliatory. Both talking about the importance of a smooth transition, and neither of them willing to make even passing reference to what I think for most of the people who voted for both of them was really, you know, just a shocking level of hateful rhetoric coming, you know, coming from the Trump campaign and Trump himself during this election. I understand some of the politics of them trying to say, you know, this is all normal here, let's have this move on. But I'm interested just what your reactions were hearing those speeches and thinking of this moment as we transition from one to the next after this campaign. Thomas, start with you.
Yeah, well, I would reiterate the point that Ian made a little while ago, which is that we have a candidate who made the most explicit racial appeals in decades, you know, maybe in the 20th century, as a major party candidate. You know, I think that sets a poisonous tone that we're seeing playing out in on campuses, on the streets, online, that it's going to take a long time to kind of tamp back. Here on my campus, NYU, yesterday, someone scrawled Trump on the door of the Muslim Students Association at the engineering school. If you go online, you can find personal recollections of dozens of these incidents happening in the last couple of days. Trump has unleashed a very poisonous force, or maybe not unleashed, but lifted the lid off of a teeming mass of racism and authoritarianism that's still there in the United States. And, you know, Ian wrote brilliantly about dog whistle politics, and one of the things that was so striking about Trump is that this wasn't a dog whistle. This was a giant shout out to some of the most retrograde forces in American society, and that's going to have damning long term consequences.
But shouldn't this be? I mean, I guess I just found it a little hard to believe that here's Barack Obama, right? This is incredibly important symbol of change in the country, certainly just in terms of just the barrier that he broke as a candidate and as a president. And in this moment, not to at least blow his own dog whistle to the people who have supported him, I don't know what I expected, but I thought there might be something different. Ian?
I think that there's both a question of strategy and psychology. I think as strategy, people are looking to a deep threat to the country, a threat that is personified by Donald Trump, a person of immense incapacities. He's volatile. He can't pay attention to anything. He's ignorant. He's bigoted. He's a misogynist. He's seems implicated in serial fraud. And we as an electorate have just put into his hands the greatest concentrated power in the world. And this is an enormous threat to the country. Now, it's not just a threat because of who Donald Trump is. It's a threat, too, because of the positions he's taken and the lawlessness, the vigilanteism, the disregard for due process, for the independence of the judiciary that he and his supporters have expressed. And so now, confronting this, on top of the misogyny, on top of the racism, confronting this grave threat to democracy, people have a decision to make. How do you best preserve our country? And as a matter of strategy, you can see the Democrats saying, well, we best preserve our country by normalizing Donald Trump. Because if we treat him as if he's a normal politician and as if his backers are deeply committed to democracy, maybe they'll actually act that way. And I think also there's this psychological element to this, which is this sort of sense of how disturbing it is to actually confront who this person is and the sort of power he wields and what he represents about a society that seems to be fracturing. And so I think that there's this psychological drive to normalize Trump and to say, okay, we thought it would be bad and we really campaigned hard for Clinton, but now that he's elected, maybe it won't be so bad. And I think that this is what we're seeing, but I think that all of us need to step back and to not allow this impulse to normalize Trump to obfuscate precisely the sort of threat he represents to the functioning institutions of democracy, to the marketplace, but perhaps most fundamentally of all, to our social fabric.
That's Ian Haney-Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics. Also with us today on Your Call is Thomas Sugrue, who's the author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. Let's go to calls now here on Your Call. Welcome, Bill in San Francisco. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Matt, I think you got it that the other commentators on your panel there aren't getting. I think a huge part of the reason that the lower-income whites went with Trump was because of basically passion and anger that he was showing, and they were responding to that. And that's also one of the reasons Bernie Sanders was doing well. And he would have probably been won, I would imagine, against Trump. A great example in the first debate when Trump came out and said, I was against the Iraq war. Well, that was obviously a mistake. You know, anybody had seen the Howard Stern video of him on it, you know, shown that he was for the Iraq war. Did Hillary hit him with that? No. She allowed him to repeatedly, in that first debate, make a point that he was against the Iraq war. And then the conciliatory speech, did she hit him? Did she say, America, you made a mistake? You elected a fool. You elected somebody who lied his way through this, and you rewarded him with it. And so they're not Hillary, and this has not just been Hillary. It's been basically since 1980. You almost have to go back to probably FDR, where you haven't had a Democratic candidate that's had shown passion. Since 1980, every Republican presidential election has basically declared war on the Democrats.
Well, Bill,
they've been rewarded.
I want to get a response to your I want to respond to your points. Thomas, come in there because we have lots of folks on the line who want to take part in this. Thank you so much for your call, Thomas.
I think we have to look not just at Trump's passion, or what you could call the performance of anger, which the caller suggests is behind Trump's appeal to white voters. It's the substance of his passion, the xenophobia and the racism, and the sometimes dog-whistled, sometimes more overt gendered rhetoric and gendered body language that he was using on the campaign trail. Yes, the guy demonstrated a lot of passion, but that passion was not without content, and the content, I think, appealed to voters as well. But I just want to go back to this white working class argument. Yes, Trump gained among white working class voters, but he won his biggest margins among middle-income white voters. I think we have to be really careful at distinguishing different segments of the population, and remember that it's whites who are living comfortably in ex-urban areas, in rural areas in particular, that were really behind Trump's success and are at the core of the Republican coalition and are the folks who find Trump's passion around issues of race and sex and immigration to be most appealing.
Let's go to Paul in Vallejo. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I acknowledge everything that's been said so far. I'm 80 years old. I voted for Clinton all the way in the primary and so forth. But I did it with a heavy heart because I wanted somebody who was from a different generation. I wanted somebody who was not reared in the Cold War and had an old politic mentality. And Mr. Obama was elected not because he was black. He was elected because he had a fresh outlook and a fresh voice. And until the Democratic Party puts forward people with that fresh voice, we're not going to get anywhere. And that's the future that we need to look to. We need to look to grooming younger, dynamic people who present a vision. Mrs. Clinton did not present a shining vision on the Hill that's going to motivate people who are going to be, as you said, the white middle class or anybody else, really. And that's where the biggest problem lies. Of course, this is not to deny the basic racist, I love the book Dog Whistle Politics, the basic racist nature of our country at this time, but we can work with it if we have somebody who has a dynamic vision.
Paul, thank you so much for your call. We're going to go straight. We're going to get a response to that from our guest, but I want to go to Suzette in Berkeley. Suzette, welcome to your call.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Matt. Listen, I am a Caucasian woman in my early 60s. I grew up here in the Bay Area, and I would like your guest to respond to me. I'm not trying to make a gross generalization, and I'm tippy-toeing through this whole idea as carefully as a cat through brambles. But it seems to me, the dirty little secret here, is that we had a House and a Senate that never forgave President Obama for being president while black. They didn't work with him, they weren't interested, and they took their toys and went home. And so I'm not saying the man was perfect, far from it, but in the whole scheme of things, it seems really obvious to me that we have many people that are frightened of what they perceive as the loss of power, 400 years of power that white people have had. And again, this is very simplistic. I know that, and I could expound on it, but I'm not going to take up any more of your time other than to say, I think that's bottom line what we really have here, and nobody wants to talk about it, and it just seems so obvious to me.
Suzette,
maybe I'm wrong.
Thank you for your call. We will give it. We will make space to talk about it right after this break that we have coming up. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar on today's Your Call, where we're looking at Tuesday night's election and the results, trying to understand them, and particularly asking what progressives and the left might learn from this election. We will be back right after this.
This is Your Call, which is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, speaking with our guests, Ian Haney-Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Also with us is Thomas Sugrue. He is the author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. And we are talking about the election on Tuesday, its results, what it means for our politics, how we understand it and how we move forward. I want to follow up on both of our callers before the break. Obviously, Thomas, you've written about Barack Obama and his role in our politics and changing them. When you hear what both of those callers said about who Barack Obama was, you know, as a voice of change, as a fresh voice from a different generation, but also as the first black president who engendered a kind of reaction and obstruction that we really haven't seen before, your thoughts?
There was a lot of celebration when Barack Obama was our first African-American president, but part of his appeal during the campaign and through most of his term in the White House was his studiously avoiding discussing questions of race, of civil rights, because he was concerned that they would be alienating to potential white voters or white supporters, that they would be controversial. And in fact, the mere mention of race by Obama when Henry Louis Gates was arrested on his front porch turned into weeks of headlines. And so Obama was incredibly cautious for most of his administration on these issues. And I think that reflected the fact that despite the unprecedented nature of the election of an African American to the highest office in land, there's a deep, deep distrust and suspicion about Obama, particularly among Republicans. Some called it Obama derangement syndrome. That is, the idea that because he was African American, Obama, who in effect is a centrist politically, was somehow far out on the political fringes, an argument that was reinforced by Trump, among others, challenging Obama's birth certificate, but was also challenged in countless other ways by, you know, Glenn Beck, who is supposedly repented, but who accused Obama of hating white people and hating the white race, or Newt Gingrich calling him the food stamp president, using a classic old school dog whistle as a way of trying to undermine Obama's credibility with the electorate. And so I do agree with the second caller that our sense that somehow we had overcome America's long divided racial past was a pipe dream in 2008. And I do think Trump's appeal to a certain segment of the electorate grew out of that sense that we had to repudiate the quote-unquote radical politics of an African-American.
And speaking of African-Americans and their right to participate, we have a call from Sarah in San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you for taking my call. I have heard many commentators in the past day and a half speaking about the lower turnout among African-Americans to support Hillary Clinton. And I had two thoughts about that. One is that it makes perfect sense to me that people who had never been represented in the highest office would turn out to support a person whom they saw as one of their own for that office. But the other thing that I haven't heard any of the commentators make reference to is that since 2012, so many people in the African American community and Latino community in particular have been disenfranchised by being struck off the voter rolls, having the poll places, the number of poll places diminished in their areas, having early voting opportunities severely restricted in one county, I heard, or one state, the available polling places were reduced from 165 to one. The incredible long lines in, particularly in districts or in voting areas that are populated primarily by African Americans and Latino Americans, and I think it's really grossly unfair to judge or characterize the African American community as not having supported Hillary Clinton when there were all these obstacles set up in the way of people participating, and a very little effort that I saw anyway of the Clinton campaign to undo those barriers.
Sarah, thank you. I'm so glad that you brought this up, and I do want to let you know, I believe that on tomorrow's Media Roundtable, we will be discussing coverage of obstacles to voting, particularly along racial lines. I want to hear from Ian Haney-Lopez. Have you been following this and what we learned from this particular election around these questions?
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. What we're looking at is a process of voter disenfranchisement that has been systematic and pursued in a calculated way, and that really made a tremendous amount of difference. These were very close elections in all of these different states. And at the margins, this sort of voter disenfranchisement, I think can bear significant responsibility in terms of the results. But we need to pause for a second there, because I think that there's two things two deeper dynamics that need to be discussed with voter disenfranchisement. One of those is just the way in which we as a society have simply not taken it for granted. I've not taken it seriously. This has been an ongoing process. We've been seeing it. It became evident in 2011, and there's been very, very little outrage, precisely because voter disenfranchisement has been couched in the language of preventing voter fraud, itself a dog whistle, preventing illegitimate voting by people of color. And I think here's where you see how race plays out, not only in the rhetoric of the right, but in the silence of the center. This disenfranchisement has been ongoing, and we've done nothing about it, and now potentially it swung an election. That's the first comment. The second comment is how profoundly undemocratic this is. We have a whole party, the GOP, organized around driving down the ability of people to vote. And it's not just people of color. Many of these disenfranchisement strategies also have a disproportionate impact on less wealthy, on poorer whites. This is a strategy for gaining democracy, not for embracing or building democracy. And I think that we need to understand that this cynical approach to democracy is driven by people of great wealth like the Koch brothers, like the major donors to the GOP and, frankly, to the Democratic Party, who see an advantage in bamboozling people through the use of racial themes and in disenfranchising people who they can't bamboozle through racial appeals, communities of color.
Can I ask, when it comes to when we talk about the strategy to reduce participation, so obviously there's the efforts at a kind of a local level through the courts, fighting the Voting Rights Act, those kind of things that have this very concrete, you know, people who want to vote can't vote. But then there's a part of it which is just about creating a politics that makes a lot of people want to tune it out. And I'm interested in, you know, I mean, Donald Trump, his ability to kind of use these reactionary statements to draw attention, to drive his base, but also to make people who prefer a more, you know, civil form of discussion or something that actually has some substance to it, to drive them away from this process altogether. Do you think we saw that on Tuesday? Thomas, Ian, either you jump in.
Yes. I think we did see it on Tuesday. We saw a lot of folks saying, "I'm sick of this damn election," and wanting to wash their hands clean from the muck that had been flying around. But you know, I don't think that goes far enough in explaining the question of relatively low voter turnout last week, or yeah, last week, 2 days ago. I think we have to take a look at the ways in which especially younger African Americans and Latinos were emphatically, I agree with Ian, the subject to disenfranchisement through all sorts of overt and covert efforts to keep them away from polling places, but also younger African Americans didn't get fired up about Hillary Clinton. They were called the rhetoric about super predators and the expansion of the carceral state in the 1990s, welfare reform, which was very much kind of rhetorically targeted toward people of color under the Clintons in the 1990s. The Latino vote was down for Clinton over Obama in 2012. And I think that has in part to do with the fact that we had the highest rate of deportation of undocumented immigrants over the last 7.5 years in the Obama administration. 2.5 million were deported, and that's, I think, had a pretty poisonous effect on Latino voters wondering whether or not the Democratic Party is going to represent their interests. Yes, I think most would agree that Trump was worse, but I think many of them weren't entirely persuaded that the Democrats were going to be all that much better.
Let's go to Lisa in San Francisco, who's called in. Lisa, welcome to your call.
Hi, thank you so much. And that's exactly what part of what I was going to say was that during Obama's presidency and also during periods where Clinton was Secretary of State, the domestic issues regarding Latino and Black people here, it was astounding how Black people could be killed in the streets day in and day out with absolutely no accountability on the part of the police force, and Obama did not really stick his neck out for Black people. And also, as far as Latinos are concerned, a lot of the young Latinos, 18-year-olds now, have felt the brunt of these deportations and the destruction of their families. And so even though there's a lot of Latinos and a lot of youth in general went out and did vote for Hillary Clinton, I thought that Hillary was very condescending to the young people as well during the campaign. And let us not forget that a lot of the policies that Clinton promoted outside of the U.S., like in Honduras, which resulted in the death and the continued death of environmental activists, Berta Cáceres, as well as in her policies towards Palestine, where activists, journalists are continuously being murdered and put in jail. A lot of those policies that here we are fearing for ourselves, people have been going through those issues. People have been suffering those conditions for quite some time in other countries. I'm Chilean American, and her friendship towards Henry Kissinger, a known war criminal, basically made it very clear that I was not going to vote for her, and least of all when she supported Israel during the bombing of Gaza.
Lisa, thank you very much for the call. We got other folks on the line. I want to make sure I'll get a response to your call, but I'm first going to go to Graham in San Francisco. Graham, welcome to the program.
Hi, Grant. Thanks for having me. What strikes me is that this is a great irony. One, she ran a really bad campaign. Rather than talking about hope and change in the Democratic primary, she was always saying, oh, no, we can't. But then her best slogan came up with, I'm with her, that's it. She came up with, make America great again. Then so many of the things that she got bit by were Clinton policies. The decline of the middle class, which has been going on, even at those $70,000 rates, their money has been going down in actual dollars since the late 1970s. Then under Clinton, we had the ownership changes in media that allowed Fox News. I was one of many people, and including in the media, who said this is going to bring in the divisiveness that is in Australia and England, and that came into effect. He passed NAFTA, and Clinton used to say, well, we're going to do it because the labor unions and this group of people have nowhere else to go. Well, in this election, they stayed home. And the granddaddy of them all, he did Glass-Steagall, repeal Glass-Steagall. And that has allowed the bank bailout. And if you ever had a clearer idea that the Obama administration and Clinton administration didn't care about the middle class, just see the trillions of dollars that have gone to the big banks and nothing on Wall Street. It's a tremendous irony that she was done in by her husband's policies and her own lousy campaign.
Graham, thank you so much for the call. This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we are doing a debrief about the Tuesday night's election, looking at the causes, what moved voters, what didn't move voters, and what it all means for progressive politics in the country moving forward. My guests today are Ian Haney-Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics, also professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, and Thomas Segrew, a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU, and author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. So Ian and Thomas, between Lisa and Graham, a heck of a lot to chew on there. Ian, why don't you choose something and respond?
I think there's a lot of insight in what the callers are saying. I think that you know, let's give Hillary Clinton some credit. When she started this campaign, she talked about mass incarceration, she talked about voter disenfranchisement, she talked about mass deportation. So in a sense, she tried to articulate a campaign that was going to address the issues of concern to communities of color. But more fundamentally, she never broke with the Clinton policies of the 90s, which is this tremendous neoliberal shift, the sort of financialization not just of the United States but of the Democratic Party. And so she had no real vision and no real credibility. She had no vision of the sort I think that Bernie Sanders showed of articulating an idea that our country is increasingly being hijacked, both economy and government, by corporations, by the very rich, and that something has gone wrong that is afflicting people of color, but also most whites, and that the way to get our country back is really to recenter people rather than corporations. She had no ability to articulate that vision. And then I think more fundamentally, she had no strategy for political change. I think everybody could see that if Clinton were elected, we were going to look at four more years of political paralysis, because her vision of politics, of governing, was to go to D.C. and to try and negotiate with the House and with the Republicans, and it was just never going to work. She had no vision that said, hey, we're politically paralyzed because we're fractured by race, by class, by gender, and the only way to regain democracy is to re-energize the people and to focus on broad social mobilization. And I think that lacking those messages, she really was not able to animate, not just communities of color, she really wasn't able to animate many white voters either.
Thomas Segrew?
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Ian said. I would add one other really important dimension, however, and that is that Trump sucked out a lot of the air during the campaign. Every outrage that he uttered for good reason got coverage, but it drowned out coverage of Clinton. And I would also say that Clinton's policies, as weakly formulated as they were, got swamped by discussion of her emails. I mean, there are hundreds of reports on her emails, and scarcely a thing on, say, climate change, one of the most important issues that didn't even make its way into the presidential debates this campaign season, because we were spending so much time talking about Clinton's emails and Trump's outrageous statements. And these are policy issues that will have really long-term implications, and we're seeing that right now in Trump's transition team. He has a climate change denier who may very well be the head of EPA, who's overseeing the environmental part of his transition team. He has representatives and lobbyists from major energy companies overseeing the energy transition. He has Chris Kobach, who's one of the most vehement xenophobes and has been behind a lot of the anti-immigration stuff, including in Arizona, who's overseeing the immigration part of his transition team. These were issues that unfortunately didn't make their way clearly into the public forum. Clinton is to blame for part of that, but I think also the media.
I think it's likely, even though you see Trump's victory speech and, you know, he's suddenly about as conciliatory as you can imagine him being, Right. And but we can, just seeing the kind of politician he was in the campaign, we can be pretty certain that the kind of shock and awe of xenophobia and racism and sexism, he'll be using those as part of his way of governing as well. And when you all think about how people who don't want that kind of divisive politics to be in control, when thinking about how they respond at a national level, we're talking about not a person-person discussion, but putting messages out into the media, out to, you know, people in the streets. What, you know, what do you think? What kind of message can counter that? What can make that so that's not so effective in drawing all that air out?
I think that one, I just want to signal something that Tom was saying,
yeah.
Thomas was saying, and to really amplify it. Part of this is Trump and Clinton, but a large part of this is the media. The media was just horrific in seeking its own benefit, its own profit, in reporting the scandals, but not reporting the substance. But now let's come to your question. What do we do now? What sort of a message do we promote now? And I think that the message is really a simple one. It's a fundamental one. It is, we have to embrace the core ideal of this country, which is out of many, one. And Trump's message is just the opposite. Trump's message is the route to greatness is division and fear. No. The greatest challenge, but also the greatest strength of this country, is our very diversity, out of many, one. Put differently, when racism wins, when sexism wins, we all lose. And I think that we have to drive that message home, that this isn't so much about taking racial offense and we're really bummed that a bigot's in office. There's that. But more profoundly, this is, hey, a billionaire who is selfish and regressive and reactionary just took office by appealing to people's worst instincts, and the results are going to be humanitarian calamities in terms of mass deportation, maybe a reinvigoration of mass incarceration, but also in terms of dismantling efforts to stop global climate change, dismantling environmental efforts, reconcentrating wealth, taking wealth from the 99% and putting it in the hands of the 1%. This isn't about feeling slighted. This is about watching real power in our country being hijacked by the very rich, by convincing us to hate each other rather than to see our shared humanity and our linked fate.
Ian Haney-Lopez, I want to. We've got just a few minutes left, and I want to get a couple more callers in. Andy in Redwood City, welcome to the show. If you could be brief, I'd appreciate it.
Hi, Matt. Good morning.
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Seguru and Mr. Lopez. I think you guys are missing the point. I think a lot of this has been baloney. 7 million voters did not show up to vote compared to 2012. Now, what happened? She was running on President Obama's legacy. President Obama completely failed the working class of this country across the board. He instituted neoliberal policies when we expected a Roosevelt New Deal. Here he is running around pushing the TPP when we have an economy that was the worst recession since World War II. We needed to create 17 million jobs from 2010 just to take care of new job entrants. He only created 13 million. He failed. Workforce participation before the recession of 2010, of 2008, 2009, I guess, was 66.2%. It's only now 62.6%.
Andy, this is a great point and a very clear one. I want to get our guest's response to it. Briefly, Thomas, you want to say, is the point just that Obama failed the working class and therefore they didn't show up to support the person he wanted?
I think that's part of the story. Obama was very cautious at the outset when he had Democratic majorities in the House and in the Senate to back him up in his first 2 years in office. Obama believed deeply in the principle of bipartisanship, and I think that led him down a problematic path early in his office, the idea that Republicans were going to reach out and be reasonable if he were reasonable back to them. And Obama was very much a product of the reshaping of the Democratic Party that began under the Clintons in the 1990s and emphasized market-based solutions to economic problems. That said, Obama also faced intense headwinds. It's on him in part, but it's not on him entirely, with a Republican, obstructionist Republican opposition in Congress after 2010. It was going to be hard for Obama to even get modest incremental changes in place. So it's a combination of both his caution and the profound Republican opposition. Both need to be put on the kind of on the fire for their responsibility here.
I want to bring one last thought in from a listener who wrote in to us, Jocelyn, who writes in, again, the issue of sexism is being overlooked. No candidate has ever been treated like Hillary for being female, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that she is a feminist, maybe not a hardcore feminist, but she was a feminist who really supported women and children and disabled people and working people and people of color and women's rights, and that keeps being overlooked. I can tell you, Simone, we're going to be doing a program next week that will address that specifically. But in our last 60 seconds, I'd like a thought from both Ian and Thomas about the role of sexism, misogyny in this campaign. Ian.
I think it was profound, and I think that the most demoralizing thing is it seemed to have very little effect on Republican voters. 90% of Republican men voted for Donald Trump, so did 89% of Republican women. Some folks presumably were offended by his mocking comments about menstruation, about appearances, by his jocular comments about sexual assault, by the allegations that he assailed various women. But whatever those qualms, they voted for him anyway. And I don't think there could be a more profound and sorry statement about the continuing power of misogyny in our political culture.
Thomas.
We have a long, long way to go in terms of feminism. We've been fighting the fight for decades, and the Trump campaign made it very clear that and the rhetoric of Trump supporters, you know, using the C word, using the B word, using all sorts of offensive language to dismiss Hillary Clinton and her supporters is a reminder that we have a very, very deep well of sexism in the United States, and we've got a long way to go to overcome it.
Thomas Sugrue, professor at NYU, author of Not Even Past, Barack Obama and the Burden of Race. Ian Haney-Lopez, author of Dog Whistle Politics, professor of law at UC Berkeley. Thanks to both of you for joining us in this conversation today.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thank you.
Having you with us. Thanks to everyone who called or emailed. If we couldn't get to you, I do apologize. We do post emails at our website afterwards, so you will definitely be heard there. Thanks to everyone who participated, and thanks for listening. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a postmortem of the media's role in election 2016. Donald Trump's victory has sent shockwaves across the globe. What role did the media play in his rise, and what should its role be now? How does the downsizing of news media, and the fact that so much of it reaches us through the filters of Facebook and Twitter, shape political coverage? Join us live at 10 a.m. with Mark Kurtzgaard and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David Latulip is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.